Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is a man who stood up.
And that man's name was?
Will Sloan, folks. Here as always with?
Luke Savage. Welcome back, everyone.
You know, Luke, loneliness has followed me my whole life, everywhere. In bars, in cars, sidewalks, stores, everywhere. There's no escape. I'm God's lonely man.
Well, unless I'm very much mistaken, Will is not actually speaking in his own voice. He's quoting from the movie we watched today, which I guess we'll get right into.
Luke, are you talking to me?
So this was my first time seeing this movie, and off the top of my head, a few comments. I mean, for one thing, it's very derivative of another film I saw recently, a little film called Joker. I'm not sure why Will subjected me to this, this testament to white male rage and toxic masculinity. So I think this is going to be more of a Will episode, because as you can tell, those are things that he holds very close to his heart.
Well, I'm always interested in the impacts that films have on society. And, you know, when I was a younger man, I saw The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. And there's a scene in that movie where Robert De Niro says, "You talking to me? Are you talking to me?" And of course, it's one of the iconic moments. But did you know he also said it in another movie, a 1976 film called Taxi Driver?
De Niro, in Bang the Drum Slowly, the critics called him a brilliant new talent. After Mean Streets, they said he was a genius. For his performance in The Godfather Part II, they gave him the Academy Award.
Come on, man. Just get me out of here, all right?
Now, Robert De Niro creates a terrifying portrait of life on the edge of madness.
Tabby, just forget about this. It's nothing.
Taxi Driver, a film by Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, people do anything in front of a taxi driver. I mean anything. People too cheap to rent a hotel room.
Oh, driver, hurry up, will you?
People want to embarrass you. It's like you're not even there. It's like, you know, like a taxi driver doesn't even exist.
This city here is like an open sewer, you know? It's full of filth and scum.
I think I know what you mean, Travis.
Yes, folks, it's here, the inevitable taxi driver episode. I was joking, of course. I've seen this film many times, this viewing just being the latest. I think the first time, as with many films we've talked about on the podcast, the very first time was with Mr. Will Sloan. I don't know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago. I saw it, I think, maybe embarrassingly later than I should. But we've talked about doing it for quite a long time. We're both keen to revisit it, and this felt like the week.
That, by the way, was the last time I saw it. You know, I saw it many times as a teenager and as a young adult. It's one of those kind of foundational young male cinephile movies. I was particularly curious to watch it now in light of, well, of course, Joker, but also the fact that people like Travis Bickle, you know, the so-called incels, the so-called white male rage, have become such a dominant force in American politics and life since the last time I saw it. I was frankly curious how this movie would hold up. I was curious if I would be as high on it as I used to be, if my relationship with the movie has changed. I think my relationship with the movie has changed. I still think it's one of the best movies ever made, folks. But it's definitely a different experience watching this in 2020 than it was, you know, when I was 17 years old or however old I was when I first saw it.
I think one of the genres of films that we've come to engage with more is great films that we're interested in revisiting because they either couldn't be made today, or if they were made, would be incredibly controversial in a way that they perhaps weren't when they first came out. Taxi Driver and everything about it flies in the face of what I think is the very literal and kind of overly didactic mode through which a lot of popular cinema is consumed today. And not just cinema, other things as well, but especially cinema. We just mentioned Joker a few moments ago, which of course is partly a remake of Taxi Driver.
In spirit, at least.
Yeah, kind of spiritual successor that has a lot of the same themes and ideas. And if you're a patron of the podcast and you heard our recent bonus episode where we talked about me seeing Joker finally, much too late. I don't know if I actually remarked upon this, but I was kind of expecting the film to be more violent and disturbing than it was. And I was sort of surprised given all of the kind of ominous buzz around it and, you know, how dark and sinister and actually dangerous this was as a text. Like, this was going to make people do mass shootings. This was a film that Was it Time Magazine refused to give it a rating because
it was Entertainment Weekly, an even more venerable rag.
right. Because giving it a rating was going to legitimize its contents. Another thing about how Joker was received is that a lot of people did process it as this kind of film about, you know, white male rage or whatever, an incel movie. A lot of the sort of buzz before it had really been screened anywhere kind of took on that character. So I was equally amazed when I saw it to see how explicit it is with its message that the Joaquin Phoenix character is really a victim of society. He's a victim of his own circumstances. He's a victim explicitly in the movie of a failing welfare state and a dilapidated public sector that's presided over by these, you know, rich financier assholes who really don't give a shit about anyone else.
And he more or less says as much explicitly when he's on the talk show at the end of the film in a little monologue that ties the themes into a bow.
That's right. And there's that beautiful moment where he says to Robert De Niro's character, you know, that he's not really political. You know, he's not able to give any kind of form or identity to his anger and alienation. He just knows that they're there, which, of course, is the case of, with so much anger and alienation. Anyway, it's fascinating in the wake of all that, that some people still had trouble with the film, still found it, everything about it problematic. It's kind of sheer existence problematic. I mean, the use of that Gary Glitter song, which I think was probably chosen on purpose. You know, it plays during one of the kind of most important scenes in the movie. I think that was probably intentional. But I think the way that Joker was received was victim to this kind of overly didactic, overly literal way that a lot of, you know, popular culture today is consumed. And given that, I think it's a good moment to revisit Taxi Driver, which is kind of the OG movie in this genre. It's not even a superhero tie-in. It's just an original script written by Paul Schrader. Can you believe that?
I've seen this movie many times. I remembered almost every scene of it, which made me all the more surprised at how upsetting I found it on this viewing.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm getting more sensitive in my old age or if the world around us has become more sensitive. I mean, the violence in the film is very tough. The sexual content is very transgressive and ugly. Some of the dialogue that Harvey Keitel, as the pimp, says is just really
so
repulsive.
Ugly.
And in particular, there's a scene that really stuck out at me. The first time Travis kills somebody, he kills a robber at a convenience store. And the convenience store owner, played by Victor Argo, he shoos Robert De Niro out. And he just, for a couple of seconds, starts whacking the corpse, the lifeless corpse of this robber with like a steel bar. And I found that violence just so viscerally repulsive and ugly. You know, the depiction of New York as this kind of like Boschian hellscape is very hard to live in for 2 hours. And I think it's all the more upsetting by the fact that, I mean, compared to Joker, which is a much more didactic artwork than this one is, this one's incredibly ambiguous. It's a film that implicates the viewer in Travis Bickle's sexism and racism. You see the whole film through his point of view, and it doesn't tell you when those things are wrong. And then at the end, it doesn't even give you the relief of seeing him punished. I mean, I remember the first time I saw this movie being very disturbed by the ending, which I'm sure we'll get into. And I was disturbed by it all over again.
Yeah, I think I had a similar experience with the movie. I'm not sure exactly why it is that it feels a little more upsetting watching it now than it perhaps did a few years ago. I'd like to think the reasons for that actually probably aren't political. I've actually found, as I get older, all kinds of violence upsets me in ways that it didn't before. And I think actually perhaps that's just a function of when you get a bit older, you actually are able to kind of grasp the implication of that kind of violence in ways that maybe you weren't at 17 or 18.
Well, a reaction that I had this time that I think is both maybe personal and political is the fact that a lot of this movie hinges on a 12-year-old sex worker. I mean, when I saw this movie at age 17, I probably wouldn't have been quite as shocked at the idea of like a 12-year-old being depicted that way. But now at 31, I find that very hard to watch. And adding on top of that, the world around us, the idea of having a 12-year-old sex worker in a movie now, it would just never happen.
Yeah, and I suppose the way we're talking, it almost sounds like we're bringing these things up to kind of indict the film, whereas I think it's actually very much the opposite. One of the reasons I think we wanted to do this movie is because it couldn't really be made now in this form. I mean, even, you know, I think we talked about this when we talked about the Joker on our recent bonus episode. Part of what Joker had to do to sort of get away with its story and character was garb itself in this kind of recognized thing that people knew, i.e. the regalia of the DC universe. You know, if you want to make a movie like that, it's got to be a comic book movie. Which kind of annoyed me, like I said. I mean, Joker to me worked as just a standalone movie. It doesn't need to have a bunch of Batman shit in it. But I think you rightly said that's like the only way that, you know, you kind of have to smuggle it in through that.
I kind of stand by the idea that that's part of the point of the movie. This is the only way that a story like this would get told now.
So let's dive into Taxi Driver. Let's talk about, I don't know, the most important scenes. I made a lot of notes during this one, and I picked up on a lot of details, visual details in particular, that I'd never really noticed before. This is probably my conservatively seventh or eighth or maybe even ninth time seeing this film. And interestingly, even though I remembered every scene, the ordering of the scenes wasn't quite straight in my head, particularly during the opening moments of the film and the end or the kind of epilogue, depending on how you look at it. I'd actually kind of forgotten little bits or jumbled them up with other parts of the movie. But it was incredible to see it all again because the film is full of contradictions and ambiguities. And I think that's why, having seen it, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 times or whatever it's been, there are things about it that I didn't precisely remember. For example, it's impossible to forget the immortal opening shots of just the cab driving through the streets of New York. It's kind of like a dash cam almost, what you're seeing, with just the dull reds and blues and kind of neon of the city shining through as kind of water beats down on the window and the saxophone theme plays. It's impossible to forget that. But what I had forgotten was that when the film opens, the actual film, the story begins, Travis Bickle is walking into the, you know, taxi company to get a job. I'd forgotten that that's where the film begins. It kind of begins in media res. And when Travis Bickle first appears, I mean, if you didn't know anything about this movie, he really does seem basically normal. This could be a movie about, you know, it could be wholesome. It could just be about a hardworking guy who's, you know, wants to drive a cab anywhere in New York City. We learn that he's a Vietnam veteran. He was in the Marines. He tells the attendant or manager at the taxi company that he wants to work long hours. He'll drive anywhere, anytime. He's particularly keen to do so at night. And that's how we're introduced to Travis Bickle. I'd completely forgotten about that.
The De Niro performance, which is very good, by the way, controversial take there.
hot take, Will.
Something that I was curious about upon revisiting it would be to compare it with his performance as Rupert Pupkin in The King of Comedy, which I had seen much more recently. The characters have a lot of parallels. They're both complete misfits who may have a few screws loose. In The King of Comedy, you regard him totally objectively, and De Niro strips himself of all of his, I guess, sexual allure. In this one, you have to buy him, actually, as somebody who's sort of suave and sort of handsome, or at least suave and handsome enough to not immediately be repulsive to everybody that he comes into contact with. You have to buy that scene where he goes into the campaign office to Sybil Shepherd and asks her on a date, and you have to buy that she would go on a date with him, but also as somebody who any connection he makes, he's running on borrowed time. It's awkwardness that, because it's so awkward, in the first couple of minutes, it might appear as not awkward.
I think, well, that particular scene between Robert De Niro and Sybil Shepherd very much mirrors the scene in which we're introduced to Travis Bickle. Mm. Her character, Betsy, she has the same knowledge of the De Niro character as we do when we're first introduced to him. And, you know, he's kind of turning on his, I guess, accidentally successful charm. You know, he's got his kind of sheepish smile and charm, and it works, at least initially. I mean, there doesn't seem to be anything, I guess creepy would be the word, about him. he seems kind of bold and confident, and it kind of works. And that's how we're introduced to him. There's nothing in that first scene when he gets the job at the taxi company to indicate that there's anything kind of unusual or dangerous about him.
But he is a little bit off a couple scenes later, where he goes to the porn theater and he makes an unsuccessful pass at the lady who sells popcorn there. Like, that's the scene that I guess is the precursor to, you know, his future indignities.
Which, you know, speaking of the King of Comedy, that's Rita from the King of Comedy, something I had never noticed before. And yeah, I mean, that, so that's an example of a scene that, I mean, I remembered, but I found it almost unbearable. I mean, it's just like he makes a really bad, unwanted pass at this woman working at the concession stand at the adult movie theater. Deeply uncomfortable. And then he tries to kind of play it cool when she's just like, you know, fuck off, asshole. Like, leave me alone. I'm not going to tell you my name, whatever. And he's like, yeah, I'd like some jujubes. You know, they last longer. I think I'll get me some jujubes, which is the kind of detail that I'd completely forgotten.
Then what exactly do you want?
Would you like to come have some coffee and pie with me?
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. I think you're a lonely person. I drive by this place a lot. I see you here. I see a lot of people around you. And I see all these phones and all this stuff on your desk. That means nothing. And then when I came inside and I met you, I saw in your eyes and I saw the way you carried yourself that you're not a happy person. And I think you need something. And if you want to call it a friend, you can call it a friend.
You're going to be my friend?
Yeah.
So one of the reasons that Taxi Driver is so iconic is because it acknowledged thoughts and feelings that men had, you know, men who were extremely lonely and sexually frustrated. At least until a few years ago, a lot of those feelings were not aired in public a lot. Paul Schrader has talked a lot about how basically he wrote this movie as an exorcism for feelings that he was having about women at that time, you know, a time when he was in extreme isolation. I think for a lot of particularly men who have seen this movie over the years, it feels like an airing out of a certain secret knowledge. I don't think it does anymore. Travis Bickle's thoughts and ideas and feelings, he says some very disturbing things about women over the course of the movie. Like, there's that scene where he says women, they're like a union. Or when he's, you know, yelling at Sybil Shepherd later on, he says, you're in a hell and you're going to die in a hell like the rest of them. I mean, those are the sorts of thoughts that would be on a message board today. But I think even as recently as 10 years ago, people watching this movie, like, it would have felt like, wow, somebody knows that these thoughts are going on.
There's a lot going on in the film thematically about, you know, masculinity. Gender is obviously a major theme of the film, but I think that another potential reading of it, which I think is working in tandem, is that it's simply a film about exclusion and one person's quest to be normal and kind of be accepted. During Travis Bickle's monologues throughout the film, one of the things that becomes clear is, above all else, he wants to be seen as normal. He wants to be considered one of the normal ones. One of the first kind of violence-tinged things he says is, you know, he's driving around in the cab and he says, you know, all the animals come out at nights, you know, and one day a real rain will come and wash the scum from the streets. And he's looking out at a neighborhood in New York where there are the adult theaters that, of course, he himself frequents, the sex workers and the pimps and the criminals. And of course, this is, in many respects, the world he himself inhabits, but he knows that it's not the upright, respectable world that he wants to inhabit. He's somebody who is almost completely lacking in any sense of self. He attempts to appear normal, but his attempts to appear normal towards other people are completely derivative. He's just sort of going through the motions of, like, things he's seen on TV or things that he thinks are kind of expected of him. He has no real sense of self underneath it all. And one of the things he says that I think is most striking, you know, he says, I believe someone should become a person like other people, which on the surface is such a simplistic statement, but which I think conveys so much about the feeling of exclusion that is really central to the character.
Something the movie articulates is that things that come easily to some people don't come easily to others. It's hard to make a human connection, for some people at least. It's hard to be natural and not self-conscious. For many people, it's very hard to know how to flirt. And I think a lot of people, and we've seen this with the rise of the so-called incel movement, there are very few outlets to express that frustration, you know? If you are somebody who is, for example, a virgin at age 25, that can be a very difficult and potentially even traumatic thing to carry around with you. I think one of the reasons this movie was so, you know, resonant and popular for so long is that for a lot of people, it articulated those feelings that are deeply unfashionable to have.
Though it's not as didactic as Joker and not as kind of, you know, clear in its moral thesis, I do think Travis Bickle's kind of material circumstances are something the film makes us aware of. There was a particular visual that I'd never noticed that's so easy to miss, which I think speaks to this. Throughout the film, we see Travis Bickle go to a restaurant where he kind of meets with various other people. You know, there's this council of like sad bastards that work at the cab company, who are the closest thing to kind of human connection that he has. And there's a scene where he's talking to them and he keeps getting distracted. And he puts some seltzer in the water that's on the table in front of him. And as the bubbles kind of satisfyingly fizz, the camera zooms into the seltzer. And if you look very closely, you can see there are impurities in the seltzer. There are little tiny specks of dirt floating around in the water. And I think this is emblematic of Travis Bickle's inability to escape the grime and poverty that's all around him. There are many things at the root of his anger and alienation and his sense of otherness from society, but this in some ways I think is foundational to it all. His feeling of being caught in this ugliness and grime and being completely unable to account for it, rationalize it, understand it in any kind of wider, you know, social or ideological way. He knows it's bad. He knows it's uncomfortable. He knows there are people that live lives considered normal and upright, and he wants to sort of be among them. But he has no language for moral outrage or even explanation available to him beyond that. So by the end of the film, violence is kind of his only recourse. This elaborate fantasy where he gets to play the hero in his own story that he erects for himself is his only recourse.
Given that his circumstances drive him to fascism, maybe now would be a good time to bring up the subplot involving Palantine, the political character.
This is the most Michael and us part of the part of the movie. I mean, we could ignore all the other themes and just talk about this because it's part of some very hallowed ground in the kind of Michael and us corpus. When we watched the film Nashville, we talked about the fictional presidential campaign and candidate that's going on kind of behind the scenes in that movie and how it's hilariously this kind of small P populist thing that's about nothing. Palantine is very much that kind of character. It's not clear whether he's a Democrat or Republican. Really doesn't matter. In fact, the script paints itself to not even really make clear what the incumbent party is. He's talking about a rival in the primary, presumably, named Goodwin, whose slogan is something like, it's almost Make America Great Again or something. It's
and
like
Palantine's, his difference with Goodwin is that his policies are more detailed.
They're more detailed. And he says, I'm going to win. It's academic to, you know, to ask me what I think of my opponent. But no doubt he would be better than, you know, our opponent. So our opponent, it's not clear, is that the incumbent president whom they're trying to oust? Is it a candidate from a rival party? It doesn't matter. It's just, yeah. It's just all of this is just kind of window dressing, which is what politics is to a huge number of people.
Whenever we see Palantine talk, he always paints his campaign in grassroots terms.
Well, his slogan is incredible.
There's some debate over what his slogan is. It's either we are the people or we are the people.
Which is the kind of sort of graphic design and like emphasis choice that in real life consultants are paid millions of dollars to, you know, figure out like which word are we underlining for emphasis.
Well, one of my favorite scenes of the movie is when Albert Brooks is on the phone with the button company and he says, well, I think there's a difference between we are the people and we are the people, don't you? And obviously the point is, no, there is no difference. By the way, you mentioned that social group that Travis has of the other cabbies. I really like them too. I like the fact that they're led by Peter Boyle as a character called Wizard, who's kind of like the grand old man of the cabbies. He's, I guess, the Chris Finch of the cabbies, because he carries himself as being this kind of fount of wisdom. That's why they call him the Wizard. And he's just, you know, totally disgusting. He says horrible things.
And I think one of the most important scenes in the film is when Travis goes to the Wizard essentially for help. I mean, he basically says, you know, can I talk to you outside?
And he can't really articulate what his problem is. The most he can say is, I just have bad feelings in my head.
Just want to go out and, you know, like really, really, really do something.
Taxi life, you mean?
Yeah, well, nah, it's, I don't know. I just want to go out. I really want to, I got some bad ideas in my head.
You know, he's able to convey enough that the Wizard understands. You know, the Wizard says, things getting you down. And that's about all the Wizard understands. But then the Wizard has this little monologue, which I saved here because I think it's so good. So this is him trying to comfort Travis. He says, look at it this way, you know, a man takes a job, you know, and that job, I mean, like, and that it becomes what he is, you know, you do the thing and that's what you are. Like, I've been a cabbie for 17 years, 10 years at night, and I still don't own my own cab. You know why? Because I don't want to. I must be what I want, you know, because to be on the night shift driving someone else's cab, understand? You get a job. You become the job. One guy lives in Brooklyn. One guy lives in Sutton Place. You get a lawyer. Another guy's a doctor. Another guy dies. Another guy gets well. And, you know, people are born. I envy you in your youth. Go out and get laid. Get drunk, you know? Do anything. Because you got no choice anyway. I mean, we're all fucked, more or less, you know? And I love that because, yeah, I mean, it's completely unhelpful. but also is kind of emblematic of... These guys don't have any language or intellectual resources available to them to explain or rationalize their situation in any kind of meaningful way. So this kind of obviously bogus rationalization is all that the Wizard can come up with. I mean, he's a guy who I guess is not as disturbed as Travis Bickle, but he's given up decades ago. And this is about where he's ended up. It's just, well, hell, you know, nothing's good for me, but I guess that's just the way of things. I look up at these expensive tower blocks where rich people get to live, and I guess, you know, some people have that, and I have this. I have my shitty cab, and hell, you know, I guess if I don't even own the cab that I drive, that must be because I don't even want to. This actually is a choice, what I'm doing. Yes. This thing that's brought me nothing but unhappiness. I am responsible for this, because I am the author of my own destiny, and individual choice is the only thing that explains anyone's kind of life outcomes. This movie, you know, I don't think it, you know, it's not, like we've said, it's non-didactic. I don't think it exactly means to do this. But it is very prescient, I think, about the kind of Reagan zeitgeist that was only a few years away when it was made. The kind of, I don't know, individualist epistemology in this monologue of the Wizard is very much what the Reagan era would kind of tell people. Although Reagan's political skill was to make all of that sound, very empowering. You've already alluded to the line, but I think my favorite line in the movie and what is so kind of darkly prescient is when Travis Bickle has been rejected by Betsy and he storms out of the campaign office and he says, I realized she was just like the others, cold and distant. Many people are like that, women especially. They're like a union. And that idea, you know, that your unhappiness is the result of some collectivity ranged against you. You know, your lack of success in romance or sex or the world of work, having a decent standard of living, having the life you want, it's because there's something out there. There's some element that's foreign to you and is a collection of nefarious interests ranged against you. That idea is such a central sort of organizing principle emotionally and intellectually for the Reaganite counter-revolution that came only a few years after this film was made.
The movie has two major female characters, Betsy, played by Sybil Shepherd, and Iris, played by Jodie Foster. both of whom Travis essentially regards as tools towards self-actualization. First, he tries to court Betsy and have kind of a normal adult relationship. And then when that fails, he channels his sexual frustration into saving a sexually abused 12-year-old girl from her sinister pimp, played by Harvey Keitel.
Travis Bickle's rejection by Betsy is such a deeply uncomfortable moment, because for people who haven't seen the film, Bickle, one of his kind of only recreational activities is going to these, I mean, they're adult films, but I guess it wasn't actually legal to screen real pornographic films in public. So the loophole was that you could go to, it was like Times Square basically at the time, and you could watch these things that were kind of technically medical documentaries or something. Like, that was the legal loophole. So, you know, these truly disgusting films that he goes to see, but he thinks this is what movies are. Like, this is what his horizons are limited to. So he knows that couples go to movies and that that's a thing normal people do.
He also knows that couples have sex and that that's a normal thing that people do.
Right. And so in trying to have sex with Betsy, he buys her an album. And amazingly, you know, it's clear she says, "Have you listened to this?" And he says, "Oh, no, my record player couldn't work." And, you know, it's pretty clear he doesn't actually own a record player. She says, "I couldn't live without music." And he says, "I don't really follow music, but I'd like to." You know, he knows that. Ah, music, right. That's one of those things that normal people do. It's not even clear what this album is. He's just bought her, like, an album. He's just, like, gone into a store and bought an album. And he says something very similar when, you know, she storms out of the movie, rightly, in absolute disgust. And he says, "Oh, you know, I could take you. I'm sorry, I didn't know you didn't like this kind of movie. I could take you to another movie. I don't know much about them, though. I don't know much about movies." Those two moments, I think, are very emblematic of Bickle's total alienation from society, his kind of bare bones knowledge about what normalcy is, that there are these things that people consider normal, but they don't have any kind of color or texture or detail to him. So this is kind of the best he can do. And then in what is probably one of the most famous shots in the movie, we see him a few days later calling Betsy from a payphone or something, and we can't hear what she's saying. We can only hear what he's saying to her. And as the part of the call comes when he's clearly being rejected, the camera actually pans away. Martin Scorsese later said, because the rejection was too painful to show on screen, which is, I think, an explanation for it that has even been somewhat controversial.
Well, regarding the porn theater scene, Schrader has suggested that having got Sybil Shepherd, he now feels the need to sully her in some way, you know, suggesting a complicated relationship with the filthy and aberrant world that he lives in. One of the unusual quirks of the porn theater scene is how ambiguous it is. You hear a lot of narration from Travis throughout the movie, but you never hear his explanation for some of his more antisocial behavior. You never hear what he thought he was trying to do with that porn theater scene. He, you know, surely doesn't even know himself.
Doesn't really fit in anywhere else in the discussion, but a detail I really liked was the scene with the street drummer, which really plays no role in the plot. There's just a guy busking and he's drumming in different styles. He's just this kind of New York attraction, I guess. And I don't know what the you know, background to that is, except that it's, you know, a wonderful little piece of kind of mise-en-scène. Maybe there was a character like that in 1970s New York.
I mean, I love that the city is so alive in the movie. You know, I love that it feels like it's like bursting at the seams, and, you know, the camera is always being distracted by people having arguments or, you know, strange looking people on the street. You know, New York has obviously been heavily gentrified since then, but the kind of hell aspect of the movie doesn't seem dated to me. All cities have neighborhoods like this, and you can imagine how, you know, being immersed in neighborhoods like this for long periods of time can skew certain kinds of people towards fascism.
Yeah, one of the thoughts I had watching this movie was that if Travis Bickle were alive today, he wouldn't join the taxi cab company. You know, he would channel his desire to see the filth washed off the streets by, like, joining the NYPD.
Yeah, exactly. This is another point that I don't know where to fit into the discussion, so I'll just make it now. Generally, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush here, but I would say that women I have known in my life, at least women I have known, have generally not been as high on this movie as I have. Obviously, this isn't a representative sample of all women in the world. I think women I've talked to about it, at least, don't regard the movie's insights into the male protagonist as particularly revelatory. I think there are a lot of women who are sort of used to being the Betsy character or the Jodie Foster character, and so don't particularly find it revelatory to spend 2 hours being told that men can be like this, you know?
Well, one thing I think the movie does, you know, admirably, although uncomfortably, is lean very hard into its own ugliness. And, you know, that's something that I think should affect you when you watch this film, kind of regardless of gender. A scene we haven't talked about is the scene with Martin Scorsese's cameo, which I think...
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's hard to rank...
Speaking of upsetting scenes.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to rank the sort of ugliness in this film, but this has got to be one of the most ugly scenes where, you know, the Scorsese character, you know, he's riding in the back of Travis Bickle's cab, and he tells him to pull over, and he points up at an apartment that they can see out the window of the cab, where there's a woman you can see standing there kind of in silhouette, you know, and he just goes off on this absolutely deranged rant about how that's his wife and, you know, he's planning to kill her.
You should see.
Right. He even talks about the things different kinds of guns can do to, you know, women's bodies. He hurls a bunch of racial epithets. I mean, to the extent that even Travis Bickle appears kind of upset by this, or at least he recognizes there's something strange and amiss here. Not sure what else there is to say about that, except that it's a, you know, a deeply ugly scene. And I think that one of the reasons the film works and also couldn't be made today is because it willingly leans very hard into things like that. I mean, in this case, putting some of the ugliest dialogue in the film in the, you know, in the mouth of its own director making a cameo.
Yeah, all but encouraging the audience to question the perspective and the motives of the movie.
I will just say, I mean, I don't question the perspective or the motives of this movie. I understand how they may make certain people uncomfortable, but I think that one of the reasons to continue to celebrate a movie like this, and I think perhaps a little bit awkwardly, Will and I have been maybe dancing around this the whole episode, one of the reasons to celebrate a movie like this is that it's perfectly fine to create art about unpleasant subjects, unpleasant, unsympathetic characters. You know, a film is not it's not a literal script giving you a set of instructions, nor is it a problem if something makes you uncomfortable. I mean, this movie should make you uncomfortable. A lot of the subject matter is deeply upsetting and deeply ugly, which I think was something both of us found revisiting it. But I think, you know, depiction does not equal endorsement is one of the most kind of elementary things about consuming or doing criticism in any medium of art. I think that really strongly applies here. And I would just say I think that it is something that is really missing from kind of a lot of popular criticism today, where there is this tendency to kind of be overly didactic about everything that comes out. You know, a film like Joker, for some people, being interpreted as this is a literal script because it contains X, Y, and Z. This is a literal kind of script that is telling you to do certain things. You know, people can't wear Joker makeup at the screenings because then they might do violence or something.
I obviously completely agree with you, with the one wrinkle that there are many, many movies about the angst of white male characters. And I think if anyone has resistance to this movie, some of it has to do with the central role that Scorsese's work occupies in the American film canon, which speaks to the sorts of themes that a patriarchal society values.
Right. Well, you know, patriarchy is kind of, has been a central structuring force in American culture and society for decades, centuries. And so I think it's perfectly fine to explore it. I think if you look at, you know, much of Scorsese's corpus, it's concerned with characters who were clearly not supposed to be sympathetic to. I mean, granted, I'm sure there are people that watch, you know, I mean, all of us remember, you know, the douchey dude in our first year dorm who had a Goodfellas poster or something and thought that, you know, Goodfellas is a movie about like really cool dudes. It's like the people that watch The Sopranos and think that it's like, these are really cool, like alpha dudes who we should all try to emulate. And this show is a documentary about how cool and awesome and rad they are.
Totally fine to explore it. But when these are the movies and these are the ideas that occupy the center of the American film canon, it does speak to what American society values and finds worth exploring.
I realize now how much she is just like the others, cold and distant. And many people are like that. Women for sure. They're like a union.
Let's move on to the last third of the movie, shall we? Which centers the Jodie Foster character, a 12-year-old runaway turned street sex worker who is under the spell of Sport, or pimp, played by Harvey Keitel. I mean, one of the scenes that I actually found really upsetting this time around was that scene where Jodie Foster and Harvey Keitel are together and she's saying to him, I don't think I like the work I'm doing, Sport. And then, you know, he dances with her and you hear him like talking into her ear about how lucky he is to be loved by a woman like her and, you know, how lucky she is to be loved by a man like him. I mean, truly, truly painful to watch.
Yeah, really deeply disturbing. That bothered me, I think, this time even more so than in previous times. Apparently, Jodie Foster's casting and her role in this film were controversial at the time. And actually, Scorsese himself, it sounds like, didn't really give her much direction. That was left to De Niro. Jodie Foster herself said later that De Niro's mentorship was really, really crucial to her acting style and to how she developed as an actress. But many critics, when Taxi Driver came out, were a little worried about, you know, having... I mean, I think Jodie Foster herself was maybe 14 at the time, something like that, 13, 14.
Still a potentially difficult situation to put a young actress in.
Yeah, and so there was a lot of concern about some of the things that she might have seen on set. I mean, I think she also did say that some of the work on set actually was quite uncomfortable. But apparently there were certain provisions in the labor code at the time around child actors and kind of the things they were allowed to see and experience on set. So for example, apparently in the climactic scene, the shootout scene, she was shown kind of all of the setup and everything was kind of very carefully explained in a way that was designed to kind of lessen the emotional blow of experiencing all this. Nevertheless, the fact that this was controversial even in the mid-1970s, I think, speaks to how transgressive a decision it really was to cast somebody so young in a role like this. There are a number of important interactions between Travis Bickle and Jodie Foster's character. There's the first interaction where he meets her properly after seeing him from out the window, or seeing her from out the window of his cab. And, you know, he pays for sex with the intention of meeting her, but then, you know, he's not interested in sex with her. He's interested in in kind of rescuing her.
Which is itself a kind of dominance, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And it's something that later Scorsese explores in The King of Comedy, where Rupert Pupkin is a character completely stripped of, you know, the sexual impulse. There's that early scene in the movie where Rita actually invites him up to her apartment and he says no.
But he still wants to rescue Rita from her life of working class misery.
That's right. And his ultimate fantasy, you know, which we actually see in the film, is just having a normal marriage and it being kind of recognized by society and all the people in his life who have wronged him. So there's a bit of that in Travis Bickle as well. In kind of their second major interaction, he meets with her at a cafe and continuing to try to rescue her, he keeps telling her that he wants to kind of buy her freedom, you know, give her some money to go off and escape. And one of the things she says through her kind of hippie goggles is, they have these communes in Vermont or something. And he's like, oh, I've never been to one of those, but they look kind of dirty. I don't, you know, which I think is a really interesting touch. You know, he recognizes the Vermont commune is encoded to him as something kind of other and not appropriately upright. I mean, because not only is he trying to wrench her from this life of exploitation that she's living, but he is trying to impose this set of heteropatriarchal, like, American values on her. It's like, why don't you go to school? Why don't you should be dating boys? You know, why aren't you following the approved social script? Here, I'm giving you money. You need to do this. in one of the most ambiguous lines of the movie, she retorts, you know, haven't you ever heard of woman's lib?
You know, after the final shootout, when we hear a letter from her parents after she's been rescued, quote unquote, and returned home, they mention that she's back at school and working hard, and the transition has obviously been very difficult for her. But we never see her past that final shootout. We never know how the transition has been difficult. We never know the circumstances that led her to running away in the first place. You know, it could easily have been sexual abuse for all we know. That doesn't really matter to Travis or to the parents.
There's one other scene I want to discuss before we talk about the ending, which I think is probably one of the most consequential parts of discussing this movie, because much about it depends on how you interpret the famously ambiguous kind of epilogue. The scene where Travis Bickle buys guns, I think, is a really important scene. It's a scene that I think has probably changed in how it comes off, somewhat at least from when the film was made, because of the extent to which mass shootings have been embedded in the popular consciousness. This utterly skeezy guy who's sort of an all-purpose criminal. He seems to sell like any vice or firearm or whatever. He's got it. He tries to push drugs onto Travis Bickle and stuff as well. And Travis Bickle, hilariously, who's just purchased, you know, this entire armory worth of munitions, is like, no, I'm not interested in that shit. As if to say, like, you know, oh, drugs? No, I don't do that. I'm normal and upright. But one of the most astonishing visuals is Travis Bickle pointing one of the guns out the window, or like towards the window, at various people on the street. The shot lingers for such a long time. It's not at people exactly. It's just at things. It's at kind of cars and just the street in general. It's as if he's pointing the gun at society itself, which is an image that's probably only grown more disturbing because of what it evokes.
He is obviously a character who would like to feel some sort of power. If he can't integrate into society, he would like to feel power over it in some way, whether by rescuing one of the female characters or by taking the life of either a mugger or a politician. That seems to be the only way he feels he can make an impact, having written off the possibility of becoming a person like other people. But let's talk about the ending, which was and is controversial and shows Travis not only surviving his suicide mission, but becoming a media hero, somebody who took down gangsters and saved a young girl. And not only is he a hero, but he goes back to his taxi job and has a reconciliation of sorts with the Sybil Shepherd character when she, by chance, enters his cab one night.
Right. So if you've never seen Taxi Driver, the climactic scene, I mean, we've kind of given it away already. You know, is Travis Bickle kind of enacting this rescue fantasy where he storms the brothel. He builds this kind of, you know, weapons apparatus, I guess, for himself, where, you know, he's got kind of guns coming out of like every armpit, and you know, he's just kind of goes in armed to the teeth, and he kills Harvey Keitel and he kills the other guy that works there. He is gravely wounded. He kind of falls into the room where Jodie Foster is. She begs him not to shoot one of the associates in the head, and he does it anyway. And then with his kind of trademark mohawk hairstyle that he now has, as the police come into the room, he holds his hand up to his own head, dripping with blood, and he motions as if the gun is going off. He's out of ammunition at this point, so he can't actually kill himself. And then there's a remarkable shot. I once read it described as a priest view shot. It's this kind of panoramic shot that's kind of high up, this very unnatural angle, and the camera very slowly glides over the entire scene, over the police, down the stairwell, out into the street where there's a huge crowd gathered and police cars pulled up. And this is where the film feels like it's going to end, and then remarkably, it doesn't, and we get this incredibly ambiguous ending that Will's just described. The camera pans to what looked like a series of newspaper clippings on a wall somewhere. It's not clear where, in Travis Bickle's apartment, in the taxi cab company, somewhere, with headlines that say things like, taxi driver heroically saves young woman from gang of thugs, or whatever. And we get this letter, apparently from her father, addressed to him, saying, you know, we tried to come visit you in the hospital, but they, you know, we weren't able to see you. You're still in a coma. But if you're ever, you know, out in Pittsburgh, you'll be a guest at our home. And then we see regular life has just resumed. So it's not clear what the status of any of this is. And there are multiple interpretations possible. To kind of lay this out for us, I wanted to turn to one of our mutual favorite film critics, although Will should get credit for introducing me to him, the film critic Robin Wood, who wrote a wonderful book that I think we've alluded to on the show a few times before, a collection of essays called Hollywood from Vietnam to Reagan and Beyond, an incredibly insightful and prescient book. He's got a lengthy passage about Taxi Driver in an essay called The Incoherent Text. There's a particularly striking set of comments on the ending, and I just want to read from them here. Robin Wood writes, "No one is likely to suggest that the ending of the film, the scenes following the point where most people at first viewing expected to end, the massacre and Travis Bickle's finger-to-forehead gesture of mock suicide, can be read quite unironically. Yet the irony seems curiously unfocused, its aim uncertain. The effect of it is a kind of paralysis, being unable to achieve any clear definitive statement about the hero, either as individual character or beyond that, as the dominant mythic figure of patriarchal culture, the film retreats into enigma. Travis becomes a public hero, ironic, feels satisfaction at what he has done for Iris and her parents, arguably ironic, and reaches some personal serenity and satisfaction with himself, doubtfully ironic. He is now able to see through and reject his angel, and mission accomplished, retreats into the streets rather as Ethan Edwards retreats into the wilderness." That's a reference, by the way, to the film The Searchers, in which there is a very similar kind of rescue fantasy enacted. And the kind of male protagonist saves a woman who does not want to be saved, in a very clear parallel with Taxi Driver. Robin Wood continues, "Rather like, but not quite, as Ethan is going nowhere and Travis is back in the heart of the excremental city. The individual spectator can think, according to personal predilection, either that the hero will continue to cleanse the city of its filth, or that the psychopath monster will explode again in another useless bloodbath. There is a third alternative which comes closest to rendering the action and images intelligible, the notion that Travis, while achieving nothing for an obviously beyond help society, has achieved through his actions some kind of personal grace or existential self-definition, and that this is really all that matters since civilization is demonstrably unredeemable." This is very Schrader. American Gigolo moves to an identical conclusion, and not at all Scorsese. "I find it morally indefensible, pernicious, and irresponsible. It implies that one's existential self-definition can validly be bought at the cost of no matter what other human beings. It also represents a debased and simplistic, again, quasi-fascist version of existentialism, restricting it to a matter of the chosen superior individual and depriving it of all social force. It could only work in the film as it does if work just means make sense in the spiritually and emotionally poverty-stricken American gigolo if the audience were identified with a single ego and all the other characters reduced to puppet-like subordination. It seems to me that at the end of Taxi Driver we are, thanks to Scorsese and Jodie Foster, more concerned about Iris than Travis, who has long since moved outside the bounds of any reasonable human sympathy or identification." So there's a lot of baggage tied up in how this final scene, this epilogue or this conclusion, depending on how you look at it, is interpreted. Is it a kind of fevered delusion? Are we seeing Travis Bickle's kind of dying thoughts? Are we seeing what he hoped would happen? Are we seeing the only kind of potential psychic resolution to all of his inner traumas? How he reconciles himself to the people in his life that he feels have wronged him and to society at large? Or are we seeing a literal depiction of what happens to Travis Bickle when he awakes from his coma and, having committed this heinous act of violence, trying to rescue a young woman who does not want to be rescued, does not want him to commit these violent acts, he's celebrated by society anyway, resumes life as a kind of a minor public hero, and is able even to let go of his interest in Betsy because he has established himself as one of the normal ones, a person like other people.
Yeah, I'm not sure. The ending of The King of Comedy is often interpreted as a dream, although I tend to take that one more literally. In this case, I'm not sure which interpretation I find more satisfying. Those who interpret the film literally point to the fact that, you know, right before the credits roll, Travis makes kind of a shifty look of the eyes into his mirror. And as the credits go on, the music turns sinister to suggest that, well, it's just been a temporary relief for Travis, and eventually he's going to get wound up again and there's going to be more violence in the future. It seems more plausible to me that it would be a dream. It seems a little bit outside the realm of credulity that he would have that reconciliation with Betsy. It's also strange that this movie, which until now has been kind of single-mindedly a character study, suddenly turns into a media satire in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, cards on the table, I've kind of teed this all up, but I do think I have a pretty clear kind of interpretation of this, you know, what this means to me. I like to think of this as an epilogue, which is kind of how I've referred to it throughout this discussion, and as an epilogue that really occurs outside of the linear narrative structure of the film. It's not exactly that it's a, you know, paranoid kind of fever delusion or Travis Bickle's dying thoughts or something like that, nor is it necessarily a literal depiction of events. I think that would be far too neat, and I think it's far too dissonant with the rest of the film for the reasons that you just said. It exists outside of the narrative structure of the rest of the film in the sense that it provides resolutions to Travis Bickle's various internal conflicts and his conflicts with other people in the only ways that are possible. It's striking that both Betsy and Iris are reduced to, I mean, they are just kind of blank canvases. Iris isn't even seen. In fact, she's kind of ventriloquized in this sort of imagined letter from her father about how she's, you know, after a difficult transition, is becoming a wholesome all-American girl, according to the social script she was supposed to follow in the first place. Mm-hmm. Betsy, who, if this were meant to be literal, it would be so unbelievably contrived. I mean, why would Betsy just get in the back of Travis Bickle's cab? It doesn't really make sense. How would that even happen? Betsy is also just a kind of a canvas onto which Travis Bickle's sense of validation, or rather his desired and sought after sense of kind of public and social validation, is projected. And I think the film makes this pretty explicit in that when we see her in this scene, we see her through the mirror on the roof of his cab. He doesn't turn around and look at her. So in a sense, she's not even really there. Or if she is really there, her function is as an extension of Travis Bickle's psyche and imagination, rather than as something that I think we're supposed to interpret literally.
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Well, we've unpacked Taxi Driver, and our conclusion is he's a walking contradiction, partly truth, partly fiction. Speaking of scenes that are incredibly painful to watch, how did you like the Albert Brooks character?
So uncomfortable.
Oh, man.
It's amazing. You know, we spent so much time talking about masculinity, and we didn't talk about the beta male in the film, who's kind of the beta counterpoint.
I have never seen in film a better articulation of the just friends relationship as I have here.
When Travis Bickle first walks into the campaign office wearing a suit, that we only see him wear it during his kind of initial courtship of Betsy, and then when he storms into the office to
reprimand her
and air out his sense of rejection, I noticed for the first time that he's no longer wearing the suit. He's donned again the kind of uniform of the taxi driver. But when he first walks into the office, you know, he says, "I want to volunteer." And Albert Brooks says, "Okay, great. You can come over here. I'll sign you up." And he says, I'd like her to sign me up if that's okay. And then just with this single look from Betsy, you know, she conveys to him like, okay, I don't really know how this is going to go, but I need you to go away because this doesn't concern you. This doesn't involve you.
And then you see him pacing around the office, always in the background of the shot, very masterfully framed.
It's so good. And then he invites, I keep almost saying Rupert Pupkin. Travis Bickle invites Betsy for coffee and he says, yeah, we can go right down the street and it's okay. It's okay. I'll protect you. It'll be in this neighborhood, but I'll protect you. And you can see, you know, the Albert Brooks character being like, God damn it. Like, I want to protect her.
What's he got that I don't got, you know? Speaking of Albert Brooks, I'm a little bit high because I formed a very brief friendship with Albert Brooks today. My future biographers will be listening to this, so they should know that this was the day that Albert Brooks briefly followed me on Twitter.
Yeah, Will had a budding friendship or perhaps something more with Albert Brooks. And I mean, I wish he had consulted me before he took further action, but you know, he got Albert Brooks to agree to come to a film with him, and of course took him to one of those filthy movies of which you're so fond. And now Albert Brooks, you know, who briefly followed only two people, you know, he has what, like millions of followers. He followed only his own wife and Michael and Us co-host Will Sloan, unceremoniously unfollowed Will Sloan.
But for 2 hours this afternoon... And now, like Harry Shearer before me, I have had a falling out with Albert Brooks.
Man, they're all the same. They're like a union.
Now watch this drive.
Fearless leader, we're so happy you called. Mm.
Have you liquidated Moose and Squirrel? Did you use the CDI?
Yes.
Are you talking to me? Are you talking to me? And who else are you talking to? Are you talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here. So you must be talking to me. And you are lying! Now catch Moose and Squirrel, and next time use the CDI on them!